everyone. I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political middle and have on the political right, Representative Ryan Wilcox.
Good morning.
Good to see you, Ryan. And also in studio, Shireen Gorbani on the left.
Hello. Hey, listeners. Thanks for sticking with us.
I've been fond of saying lately that the world's on fire. It feels like the nation's on fire right now, whether it's college campuses, but certainly the Trump criminal hush money trial. You know, the jury's been seated. It started this week. It's so much chaos, Shireen. I often wonder how the American public just puts up with this.
Well, I would say in some ways they don't, right? When we think about things like how they view the president, kind of regardless, Trump or Biden, the recent polls haven't been good for either, right? Mm-hmm. When we think about how they review Congress, not good. When they think about, even at the local level, you know, feelings, sentiments towards our own legislature aren't overwhelmingly positive. So I do think that there's sort of a general sentiment that people need to get their act together.
Yeah. Ryan, one of the things I think about, you know, whether you feel that this is politically motivated or however you think about it, this will not play well with American women. In my judgment, the term catch and kill, the things we know about immorality, infidelity, the trouble that it causes in families and morals, it's not a good look for our president, our former president.
I have no idea what you're talking about with catch and kill.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So this is a process that's used when tabloid reporters were given heads up about particular stories. And they are, the literal meaning, right, is that they catch those stories and they kill them. And they kill them by providing hush money or payments or different incentives to people, sometimes to stop them from, you know, going public with their story. So there's a great book on this, actually.
Yeah, well, that's interesting you bring up the book, because, Ryan, the way I became familiar with the term is a friend of mine in town said, hey, have you read this book called Catch and Kill by Ronan Farrow?
Yeah.
And she said, I'm sending it to you. And, of course, it was the Harvey Weinstein Hollywood producer abuse of power. You read it and it just chills you to the very bone.
Yeah.
Okay, so the position that young women are put in.
I was going to mention this a little bit earlier before you asked that question, but you asking that question and me having no idea what you're talking about is emblematic of this. We are not in the same places. And I mean, as a people in general, like, so you have, yes, we've been on some level of being on fire for how many years now?
Mm-hmm.
At least four. Right.
I thought we were on fire like in 2008 and it was nothing.
Right.
It was sort of nothing. Right now, I mean, literal World War III is probably starting in the Middle East or well underway, you know, depending on your perspective on how that's going. You have the campus stuff, I think, is easy to look at. And I said, I'm sorry, we're actually blocking Jewish students from participating on campus now at an Ivy League school. Okay.
And disinviting pro-Palestinian speakers as valedictorians as well.
Okay. Well, whatever. But both of that is just so, it's so absurd, so on fire that I think I just came down from, you know, northern Utah, drove into Salt Lake, and everything seemed pretty normal. So everybody's, you know,
all is
generally
well in Zion.
Functioning.
Yeah.
Right? We don't have chaos in the streets here. So it might seem like that.
I was going to say, I've heard some of your colleagues suggest that that is what we have here. But I would just say that I think that there is a deep sentiment that our politics in this country are broken. And day to day on an interpersonal level, when people have these conversations, honestly, like we do here, right? Mm-hmm. There's a sense that agreement can be found, sides can be seen, dignity can be preserved. But when we think about, I think, sort of these large scale fractures and fissures that are happening, and then along with that, the undermining and lack of trust in some of these key institutions, whether it's thinking about what happened with hospitals in COVID or thinking about what's happening on colleges' campuses now or has happened over time, there is an erosion that we've talked about, Natalie, in faith in our institutions. And I think that that is coming on the heels of a deep downgrading in our faith in our leaders.
Yeah. I've been watching the coverage in New York as, the University of New York, also of Columbia, has this incredible shutdown of classes, police presence, I'm familiar with college protests. When I was in college, it was apartheid.
Yeah.
They had a camp on campus that was, you know, that lived there constantly that was opposing apartheid. But the difference is that this is actually shutting down learning, research, instruction.
Yeah.
So divisive. And I guess I just have to ask the question. I'll throw it to you, Ryan. What do you see next? you know, like we operate on an academic year in the university setting. I bet you these presidents can't wait for the academic year to end, which is in the next week.
I've had
or so.
That conversation with some of them.
Have
and
you?
that is exactly where
they're
at.
They just need the students, the faculty to go home
mostly
for a while.
In the context of their security teams and their security plans, right? Yeah. Like we just got to get to June.
Yeah. Really interesting. Yeah. Shireen, we're also hearing word that at least it's not coming from the Romney camp, but there's a movement afoot to try and recruit him to be the next president of Harvard.
Yeah.
So our Senator Romney, your thoughts?
Well, I am starting to believe that, you know, a role in Congress is a pretty bad job. And I think the one that might be worse is president of a high profile university.
Fair enough.
The times are tough in these kinds of positions. And I think, you know, moral courage, the kind of leadership that we need to see through these difficult times. I think he would bring a really important perspective, but I also feel like these are starting to become impossible jobs.
Mm-hmm. Ryan, you have a friendship with former Senator Ben Sasse, who's now president of the University of Florida.
University of Florida, yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about? Should he take this job?
Well, that was the first thought, right, is one, what Shireen just said, this is impossible. In that environment. That said, Mitt is the consummate executive. Mm-hmm. And I think I would have loved to see
him
as the president, more so than in Congress. I think it's been insanely frustrating for him. Ben is sort of awesome in that role. He's already done that as the university president in Nebraska. And as surprised I was to see him leave his term, you know, midway through, he's succeeded in that. I also think Harvard, you're right, is very different than Florida.
Mm-hmm. Just real quickly, the two of you, what do you think Romney does next? I mean, there's this thing out there, but it's really hard to go from relevance to irrelevance. It's actually harder than like losing money. And he's such a talented
guy.
I
never had enough money to just find
to
out.
To know that.
That's
what the social science literature says. But what do you think's next for this guy, Ryan and Shireen?
I don't know. He's built a reputation as a turnaround artist in an executive role. And so I can see that temptation. He loves the university. He served there. He attended there.
Got both an MBA and a Juris Doctorate from Harvard.
Yeah, yeah. And so there's an investment. There's a personal investment for him. I think it probably depends on Anne.
Yeah.
And what Anne feels about that decision and her grandkids. And that'd be a hard decision to make, but he was the governor of Massachusetts.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's feasible.
Yeah. I would just say as a person who thinks about retirement as an unbelievable privilege. Mm-hmm. I mean, many people don't get to experience that. Mm-hmm. He has sacrificed a lot for this country in service. And I know that it may seem like irrelevance, but can you imagine politically, we're not deeply aligned, but I have had a couple interactions with him, and I just feel like it would be so fun if he were your grandpa, like to have him around. So I think that there is something about just saying thank you for your time and really getting some of your life back.
Yeah. Shireen, one last thing. Did you notice that the Biden administration updated the Title IX rules? They've now codified the rights of transgender students and they've, you know, put aside some of the Trump era prohibitions or whatnot, rollbacks on some civil rights.
So many in the trans community were waiting for this for quite a while. So this was a quite extended decision. And my understanding is there are still particular parts of the provision that are not where people hoped that they would be. I would just say so much of this is really down at the state level where I don't know if you caught the news this week, but just watching schools try to implement the May 1st implementation date of the trans bathroom ban that we have going into effect in our schools right now. In the piece of legislation that was passed, it said all students needed to be informed of this change that was coming so that accommodations could be made. And when the school district started to move forward to educate all students, my understanding is they got word from the legislature saying, no, we didn't want every student to know that this new process was in place. And so there's been a lot of, again, kind of chaos in people's lives over really a very intimate practice, which is going to the bathroom. So we have this sort of trickle down, or I guess I would say localized hysteria that's playing out and really complicating kids' lives.
Any comment, Ryan?
I don't know. I mean, the word the legislature is used a lot. It's 104 different people. So I have, again, no idea who she's talking about. that might have said.
Yeah.
I saw a story about myself this weekend that was so backwards, I don't even know what to say.
Yeah. Well, if you voted for the bathroom bill, then you are implicated in this. But it really is one of the things that the educators have been saying is that having a May 1st implementation date for something in our schools is something that they would hope that you all would consider not doing in the future, considering it is right at the end of the school year. A July or a June 1st implementation date is much...
Just by default, that's the default date for them. So if the drafting attorney in the education space, they could easily say, okay, Ed bills in the future, we're going to make that July 1st.
With
it.
Yeah.
Like, whatever.
Yeah. I have to say, one of the reasons I love being with the two of you each week, and I love both sides of the aisle, is I learned so much. And I didn't know this May point. And it's a really good point. And I don't know if Ryan knew it.
But it's difficult.
Well, serious. Odds are Ryan knew it.
Serious, because that's, why would you start something with 3 weeks to go?
Yeah, in what is the most stressful time for teachers.
Yeah. Really interesting.
Yes, I should clarify. Yeah, in the education space, I hadn't ever thought about that being different for Ed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's the part that...
That's the both sides of the aisle gift.
I've been preaching to everyone who's called me. They always panic it right before the session starts.
Yeah.
Right? Hey, can you guys run this bill? Yeah, actually, no.
No.
Like, that started... The session started last May.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, implementation, you know, like, these go into effect May 1st, and I think that day I can start opening bill files for next year, and that's when the work starts.
Interesting. Yep. Hey, we've got a lot for you in the second segment, so stay tuned. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gurbani and Ryan Wilcox.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gurbani on the left.
Ryan Wilcox on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the Political Center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. Shireen and Ryan, I'm going to go through kind of a lightning round of just a whole bunch of local issues. I think they're all really interesting. We're going to stay with Senator Romney for a minute and talk about the fundraising for those that are challenging him and what that looks like. Representative John Curtis, who's now running for the Senate, has raised nearly $1.4 million since he jumped over to the Senate side. Wilson has got, what, a total of nearly $2 million this election cycle. And then you got Trent Staggs, Mayor Staggs, with, you know, much less.
Yeah.
You know, less than $500,000 or something.
So I'm not sure on Curtis, but I do know that Wilson was able to give himself a pretty substantial contribution. So you're able to pay yourself back, actually with interest, which is interesting, which was to the tune of more than $1.5 million, I believe.
Yeah, he's giving himself another million.
Yes. So there's a certainly a large discrepancy there, but it's actually not that big of a discrepancy between Brad Wilson and Trent Staggs if you're looking at just dollars raised. John Curtis, my guess is, just when you're inside that political machine, the kinds of phone numbers you have, the Rolodex decks that you have, it's no surprise to me that he's able to raise that kind of money.
He should be able to.
Yeah.
He's in the Beltway.
State convention, April 27th. How do you see this playing out, Ryan? I mean, both Curtis and Wilson are on the primary ballot because of signatures, correct?
Yep.
Yeah. So the convention is a nice to have, but not a must have.
Yeah. I think it's, if I were betting right now what happens at convention, I think Staggs probably does it.
Really? Wow. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you'll get all three of them pushing on to the primary ballot.
Which just lowers that threshold because we never did flick plurality.
Uh-huh. And what do you think about what's going to happen with our gubernatorial race? Does Phil Lyman have a chance of coming out of convention?
Convention? Phil or Carson could. It's, you know, that's possible at a convention.
I have to tell you, if you're the sitting governor that's as popular as Governor Cox, and if you go to your convention and get a challenger, boy, is that defeating. I've felt that in the Leavitt administration.
Sure.
Yep.
And you're just like, you have an 80% approval rating and your convention gives you a challenger when you're, you know, just, you're like the head of the party at that point, you know?
Yep. Yeah. And I just attended a bunch of county conventions where the governor was cheered and booed at different points. He actually handled it pretty brilliantly in Weber.
Tell us what he did.
Guy right on the front row. Yeah. Yeah. Just giving him a hard time. The governor stopped his speech and addressed the person directly. And invited them to run. So, you know, this is the, you know, this is very difficult. I just love to finish my, I'm shorthanding this. I would just, you know, if you just let me finish my thing. You can boo me as much as you want as I walk off the stage. I just need to finish a few comments and you can do whatever you want. Please do your thing.
Yeah, he held his composure.
He held his composure,
yeah,
handled it brilliantly. And I heard from a bunch of delegates that they really appreciated that.
Yeah.
They were like, he just didn't say don't boo. He just said, just give me a chance to say my two sentences and
Yeah.
You can do your thing. So I think he's getting better at that.
Did he go with a don't boo vote kind of situation?
No, he didn't.
An Obama
line. Didn't even.
No.
Oh,
yeah, don't boo.
We both looked at you like, what?
Yeah.
I wasn't watching Obama speeches a lot.
Yeah, you might remember. Former president.
Shireen Vivek Ramaswamy, which is amazing I can say his name, but he got so much attention during the debates. But he's come into our market and endorsed Trent Staggs.
Yeah. So, you know, Trent Staggs has really pulled some interesting endorsements, including, I believe, Matt Gaetz, Ramaswamy, and Tommy Tuberville, I believe, was also here. Yep. So it gives you a sense of the kind of ideology or the environment ecosystem that he is thinking in.
Yeah. Okay.
That's certainly the folks that he's courting.
Yeah.
Right.
So we want to do downwinders for just a minute here. We have both Senators Mike Lee and Senator Mitt Romney helping to sponsor a bill on radiation exposure. And then I guess Representative Celeste Malloy and Representative Burgess Owens are also co-sponsoring in the House. Ryan, give your quick take on this. I mean, I thought that we solved this, but it sounds like they extend it and are going to get more money for these families.
And could you also just give a quick, I think most Utahns know, but just a really quick explanation of what a downwinder is.
Yeah, I want to say very first thing, how proud I am that that happened, that was let out with Senator Lee and Mitt Romney co-sponsoring, because this is not speaking of both sides of the aisle, this is not a partisan thing. It should never be. But, you know, our state, our community, our nation, but especially those of our families who lived during that time period when we were above ground testing nuclear weapons at the Nevada test site, were directly lied to by the government.
And poisoned.
They were advertised. They'd send out advertisements to them in special glasses. Go stand
watch
outside
it.
And watch this beautiful pink cloud. And all the while, the scientists knowing that the fallout would harm them. The government knew these things. And so this reimbursement, this is bizarre. This is covering medical treatment for people that our government is responsible for their death and suffering. So the fact that that's taken this long, that we have to fight about it every few years for reauthorization is infuriating. But I've met so many of these families. Former Representative Selig and I did a lot of work on this in 2010. Trying to solve this on the state side. But I'm just right now, that news, I'm extremely grateful to see that that has happened and that we've made enough progress to where this is not viewed as a partisan thing anymore.
Thanks for sharing your insights there. Shireen, we've got our Attorney General, Sean Reyes, who now the State Records Committee has unanimously ruled that he must turn over his calendars. Of course, the legislature made calendars private, but not on a retrospective basis, which doesn't help Mr. Reyes. And that tells me the legislature knew exactly what they were doing. You can say if you want to say something, Ryan, but you think we're going to see these records?
For the legislature.
Yeah. So I would say that I believe there is a reasonable expectation that if you are being funded by taxpayers, that we should know what you are doing with your time. And I understand that's more complicated when we talk about a part-time legislature, when we talk about people who are in even, you know, often uncompensated roles. But there is some sense to this for me in terms of a person whose full-time job is serving the people of Utah. There should be greater transparency there. So I don't think this is good for him, especially considering some of the shenanigans he's certainly been involved in that we've talked about on this show many times. But to think about just the retrospective kind of production of these, I still think we're not going to see them. But I'm glad that this was the ruling.
What do you think, Ryan? Do you think we see these records?
I'm going to say in the conversations that I'm aware of, the fact that it was retrospective wasn't broached at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't in the middle of those. As far as the records, we also talked about pretty openly with our counsel and, you know, the attorneys, that this was always the understanding of Grandma, that calendars were never a part of it, that this was a... You know, and so it wasn't a change in policy. In fact, they've responded the same way for forever with the no, that that's not, you know, part of what we provide as part of Grandma. It wasn't part of the law. So the legislature, I can say that, those that voted for, view that as continuation of the same policy.
Yeah, interesting. I have some background in this when I worked at a senior level in Governor Leavitt's office, and I was his director of communications. So I worked with the media and the sharing of records, right? They would just ask for his calendar. Actually, we send it out every 2 weeks.
Yeah, governor publishes it.
Yeah, we send out. But it's interesting to me because what I learned in that process is you could be having things internally that were just, you know, governor staff time, strategy time, where you're doing a lot of really newsy things. But when you ever left the state, when you were traveling and the state was sending detail, security, buying these tickets, you know, having you meet with leaders of some significance, either national or international, it seems to me like that's something the public ought to know about.
Yep. Agreed.
Oh, different gradations. Okay.
There's probably a good argument there, Shireen, to your point about the full-time thing.
I think there's a difference. I really
right.
do.
Yeah. Ryan, I'll stay with you and then we can let Shireen talk about this. But Salt Lake County had their convention and Natalie Klein, the school board member that did some pretty offensive things, didn't make it through. We got Amanda Bollinger is going to be the candidate for that seat. Any commentary there?
Well, caucus system works.
Sure.
There you go.
I would just say, I'm guessing that people who were bothered in particular by, I mean, what she tried to do was out a trans student who was not a trans student. So she created a lot of pain and suffering.
Bad on top of bad.
Right. So it would have been bad to out a trans student, period. Right. And it's also bad that this kid was put in the spotlight for the reasons of state school board member bullying them online. Like this is, it's unconscionable to me.
This applies to any student.
It does to me.
Oh my
it does.
Gosh.
So for me, even just another level of upsetting, but I will just say I am proud of those people who probably saw that happen, got upset, became a delegate, went to work and did not support her reelection. So, or her pathway, I guess, to reelection. So I'm grateful that somebody got in the race. I'm grateful for all those delegates who got involved and showed up. And I just would say, yeah, I mean, I don't know if you're kidding, but these caucus systems are vulnerable to people who care. You can show up.
You can.
And
Amanda Bollinger gets 63% of the delegate vote.
That's always been the case, right? Like that's why sometimes people that are in power don't like it.
Yeah.
Because it can work.
Both ways.
It can work.
Yeah, both ways. Okay, Shireen, and then we'll go to Ryan, but school district statewide bans on sensitive materials. So these are the book ban legislation. I haven't followed this very closely, but I did find it surprising that this new state law says that there can be a statewide book ban if at least 3 school districts or 2 and 5 charter schools decide to ban a title.
Yeah. So I find this to be absolutely a step in the wrong direction. I believe that there are, you know, really serious professionals who work on what kind of access to what kinds of books children should have in our schools. People who get, you know, professional degrees in library science and work on these issues to try to make sure that we can increase empathy and understanding of different life perspectives. What we know is that over and over again, the majority of books that are banned are often about queer kids' lives. Queer people, queer authors are writing them. Women disproportionately in Utah are represented. And the one that really broke my heart was The True Diary of a Part-Time Indian by Alexei Sherman, which is one of my favorite books. I think when people want to pass these laws, it is around a fear of opening up people's minds to the world. And perhaps we should just trust people to be critical thinkers and have the tools they need. The thing that's most upsetting to me about this is that it does not seem that there is a way, and I will follow up with this, listeners, for people to appeal. There is no, like, these are getting pulled off of Salt Lake City bookshelves. Salt Lake City School District did not ban a single book. But now we all have to live in this environment of anti-intellectualism. Yeah.
Okay, that was pretty strong, Ryan.
I
don't know if that got under your skin at all, but I will say it surprises me from the political middle that we don't allow a little bit more local control.
That's right.
Why not just let school districts administer this? But let's hear from Ryan.
Sure, and not my bill again. That said, some of that is not at all how that happens. And one of the things I've always struggled with in this context is this has never been a ban. Like, let's go to the definition of ban. What we're saying is they're not provided in the public school. That does not mean banned. They are still on the shelves. They are still, like the classic government bans, they burned the books. That is not happening. Mm-hmm. What is happening
is... Don't give anybody ideas.
Well, come on. Like, words mean things.
Yeah, it's
right?
A ban when you cannot access it in school. That's where many people access books.
Hey, Ryan and Shireen, I had a book. I remember having books that I hid under my mattress so my parents wouldn't find them.
Yeah.
I think it was actually, in retrospect, a really healthy thing.
Yeah.
The stuff that got... So one of these books got sent to my house, okay, by a concerned parent. The stuff that we've seen sent into us is so far beyond anything appropriate for a public school. I haven't referenced the one. I don't know the book that you were talking about, but I read straight up literary porn from a junior high school library that night. Okay. Yeah. Shouldn't be banned. You can buy it on the open market. You can put it in your home, whatever, you know, if all these groups that want it in the schools feel really passionate, I'm sure they could do something on their own in the private sector. But requiring your neighbors to supply what amounts to child pornography in some cases and sexual abuse to provide it in the schools, I don't know how that's responsible.
So most of these are being pulled by just a couple of people. So really what's happening is a small group of people are determining what your kid has access to in schools, and I think that's bad.
We have to end it there, but what an interesting conversation. Thank you both. Shireen Gorbani, Ryan Wilcox, Natalie Gochner. Thanks everybody for listening. Anthony Scoma produces the program.